From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one answer to the question, why would a young man carry a gun? Nathan McCall used his gun, served time, and he's changed. He's now a reporter with the Washington Post and the author of a new memoir. Also today, we talk with drummer Arthur Taylor about recording now classic sessions with Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis. Taylor interviewed many of his fellow musicians. His book of interviews has just been published in a new edition. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Irrawaddy Tango by Burmese novelist Wendy Loy Yeon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says the Bosnian Serbs are in effective compliance with NATO's demand that they move their heavy guns away from Sarajevo. The southern European NATO commander is warning the Bosnian Serbs they still face airstrikes if they violate the NATO ultimatum. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
U.S. Admiral Mike Borda said the mission was not over. NATO forces would be prepared to strike if the shelling of Sarajevo resumes or if the Bosnian Serbs try to move heavy artillery back within range. Borda said he expected complete verification of weapons withdrawal around the Bosnian capital would be complete later today. NATO had threatened air attacks unless Serb and Muslim forces gave up their heavy weapons and withdrew them at least 12 miles from the city. Some commentators say they hope the tough NATO stance, which achieved results in Sarajevo, can now be applied elsewhere in the Balkans conflict. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
North Korea is threatening to back out of its agreement to permit international inspection of its nuclear facilities. Pyongyang says the international community is pressuring it to let inspectors look at even more sites. The statement came just before Japanese Prime Minister Morihiro Hosokawa said he would work with the United States to increase pressure on North Korea to open all of its facilities. The North has agreed to let inspectors visit 7 declared nuclear sites, but Japan and the United States want inspectors to visit 2 other sites where nuclear weapons work is suspected to be going on. Congress is getting ready to debate a constitutional amendment to balance the budget every year. If Congress passes that amendment, 3/4 of the state legislatures would have to approve it too. That could take as long as 7 years. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
There's growing support for a balanced budget amendment, enough to stop a threatened filibuster by opponents in the Senate, but not enough to pass the measure. West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd, chairman of the Appropriations Committee, is leading the opposition. He says the amendment is a sham. It would require a balanced federal budget beginning in the year 2001 unless 3/5 of the House and Senate vote to allow a deficit. But because state legislatures must ratify it, the amendment wouldn't take effect for years, which is why opponents say it's merely a grandstanding effort. In 1986, the Senate failed to pass it by just one vote. President Clinton opposes the idea. He says it would require increased taxes and drastic cuts in programs such as Medicare and Social Security. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
The last Red Cross shelter set up in Southern California for earthquake victims has closed. The Red Cross had put up 47 shelters to house thousands of displaced people affected by the January 17th tremor. A spokeswoman said the agency found temporary shelter over the weekend for the last 40 people. The stock markets are closed today. This is NPR. Researchers say the drug AZT can prevent women who have HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, from passing the illness onto their fetuses. Tests find that only 8% of the babies born to infected women who took the drug had the virus. The New York Times reports that AZT was so successful in testing that researchers have stopped experimenting. Instead, they're telling medical centers to offer the drug to women who were getting placebos. The associate director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says this development could cut in half the numbers of babies born with AIDS in the next year or so. No American won a medal today in the women's 1,500-meter speed skating event at the Winter Olympics. Bonnie Blair finished in 4th place. NPR's Mark Schramm reports.
Bonnie Blair was not expected to win this one. She's a sprinter, and the 1500 is considered a middle distance event. Still, she skated her best race ever. Her time of 2 minutes, 3.44 seconds set a U.S. record. But that was more than a second behind the winner, Emise Hunyadi of Austria. Svetlana Fedokina of Russia took the silver medal. The pre-race favorite, Gunda Niemann of Germany, came third. The U.S. has not medaled in the women's 1500 since 1976. On Wednesday, Bonnie Blair competes at a more comfortable distance, 1,000 meters, where she will be the favorite. A win would give her 5 Olympic gold medals overall, more than any other female U.S. athlete. I'm Mark Schramm in Hamar, Norway.
An Israeli government minister says this ought to be a good week for Mideast peace talks. Israel and the PLO have begun negotiations in Egypt. Israeli radio says talks on Palestinian prisoners will lead the discussion. The discussions are intended to implement the Palestinian self-rule accord that was supposed to take effect 2 months ago, but there have been disagreements on security and other matters. Meanwhile, hundreds of Jewish settlers have set up temporary roadblocks to protest this weekend's murder of a pregnant Israeli woman. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you hear about teenagers shooting other teenagers or holding up stores at gunpoint, you may ask yourself, what leads a young person to do that? We're going to hear what led one young person to do that. My guest, Nathan McCall, served 3 years for armed robbery. While he was in prison, he discovered books and writing. He wrote the head of Norfolk State University's journalism department and told him he badly wanted to make a new start. McCall was accepted to the school and studied journalism after he was paroled. He now writes for the Washington Post and has written a new memoir called Makes Me Wanna Holler. Nathan McCall grew up in a black working-class suburb in Virginia. In the opening chapter of his book, he describes how he and his friends once beat up a white teenager who made the mistake of bicycling through the neighborhood. I asked McCall why they decided to attack him.
It was the kind of thing we didn't even have to decide. It was almost instinct. You know, it was instinct. The sense of hatred was there. And so this white guy became available, accessible. And so we automatically took off after him. We were just sort of programmed for it at that point.
So what were you thinking when you were kicking him?
I can't tell you exactly what I was thinking, but, it was a release. I know at that point I felt that I hated white people, and my buddies felt the same. And so, you know, it was not a lot to think about.
Do you think that the hatred that you had for white people that he kind of symbolized at that moment, was it kind of abstraction of white people, or was it about specific white people? Did you know a lot of white people? Was it the larger historical issues, or something more personal?
It was an abstraction,
uh-huh.
You know? We knew that, well, I knew. I was angry, but if you ask me specifically who I was angry at, the best that I could tell you was that I was angry at white people. You know, I had this sense that my life and the lives of my parents and the lives of all the other black people I knew were controlled and oppressed by white people who controlled these amorphous institutions. And it was seldom were they accessible to us. And so whenever one became accessible, we took the opportunity to take out our anger on him.
Now you're not from the kind of family where it was inevitable that you were going to turn to guns and crime, or the kind of neighborhood where that was inevitable. I mean, your father was a career military man. You lived in a decent home. When you were young, you were into spelling bees and the honor roll. And from your book, it sounds like you started to change at about when you were age 12. What happened?
My stepfather, he was a hardworking man. He worked at the local naval shipyard. And he also kept a part-time job. He always kept a part-time job to earn extra money. We lived in a working-class neighborhood. My stepfather, on weekends would take my brothers and I across town to this affluent white neighborhood to work in white people's gardens. And that was his part-time hustle. And I was about 13 then. And the civil rights movement was beginning to lose momentum. And the Black Power movement was picking up steam. And we were hearing, you know, there was this new black pride and this defiance against white people. And some of that had filtered down to me. And so when we would go out to this white neighborhood and work in these people's gardens, I resented it. And I began to resent my stepfather for taking us. And I hated the sight of my stepfather. He was a big guy, still is, big guy, about 6'2", sort of heavy set, you know, solidly built. The sight of him on his knees working in white people's gardens while they stood over him and supervised just didn't sit well with me, you know? And by that time, I had already had some very traumatic experiences with white people. I had been sent at age 11, I had been sent across town to a mostly white school, and, you know, I encountered the rage of white kids throughout the school. I mean, constantly. They attacked me and taunted me, and as an 11-year-old, I didn't understand it. And my parents weren't very educated, and they didn't have the sophistication to explain to me what I might encounter in this school, the racial hostility. And so as an 11-year-old, I couldn't comprehend that.
Your stepfather tried to discipline you. He tries to impose a curfew. But none of what your parents did was effective. Could they have done anything that would have disciplined you or encouraged you to change your ways and stop stealing things and stop getting into fights?
You know, that's hard to say. That's hard to say. I've often wondered about that. And I thought about it a lot in trying to steer my own son when he came to live with me as a teenager. And, you know, I thought a lot about why I had rejected my stepfather as a role model because he didn't fit my image of what a man should be to my way of thinking. A man, a black man, should be someone who could stand up to the white man. And I didn't feel my stepfather did that. The other thing was that while my parents were very good, they came from the generation, a generation, that their idea of raising children was that, you know, you made sure that they were fed and clothed, and that they had, you know, a decent place to live. And that was about as far as they could take you. You know, they could give you the basic values. Don't, you know, go to school, study. But they couldn't communicate with us very well beyond that. And that's important, I think. It's important for all kids. But it was important to us as black kids trying to figure out our place in this society. We needed someone who could communicate with us about what we were going through and what we would be going through, that sort of thing. I tried that with my son. You know, I tried to create an atmosphere where we could talk about anything, where we could listen to his rap tapes and debate whether, you know, I remember once he came to me late one night and asked me if it was okay to take it from a girl if you took her out on a date and she wouldn't give it up. And I was tired and about to go to bed. And when he asked that question, I knew it was going to be a long evening. And we must have sat up until about 3 o'clock in the morning just talking about women and their perception of women, my perception of women when I was his age.
I find your book really fascinating because there's so many things that I think those of us who haven't lived the kind of life you have find it really difficult to understand. Why would somebody do that? How can somebody do that? Mm-hmm. And you try so hard to explain, you know, what was going through your mind during certain periods of your life and when you got yourself into certain jams. And I think it's just really fascinating to read and to hear you talk about it. So I want to move on to another incident in your life that I think was a real kind of pivotal point for you, very dramatic. Someone had insulted your girlfriend, and this was the girl who was your son's mother. And you felt that the right response was to shoot this guy. What did he do that you thought merited that strong a response?
Well, I mean, that goes back to the issue of respect. You know, we had some very clear ideas about what constituted disrespect.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things was that you did not allow anyone to disrespect your girlfriend. I read stories occasionally nowadays where guys get shot over disrespecting somebody's girlfriend. It was part of the street code. And so this guy, he offended my girlfriend. He called her a name, and she shot him a bird. And she told me about it, and we saw him at a carnival a short time after that. And we had the baby with us, and we were pushing the stroller, and this guy and some of his buddies approached us. And the guy, we called him Plaz. He was an older guy, and he approached us and said something else to my girlfriend. And so at that point, I decided I had to shoot him. You know, he had broken all the rules, and there was no way, to my way of thinking, mm-hmm. as a teenager, there was no way that I could let him get away with that and hold my head up. And so I had a gun on me. And he kept talking and got louder and louder. And so I pulled the gun and shot him.
Where'd you shoot him?
I shot him in the chest. We were about, we were standing about 3 feet apart. And I just pulled the gun and fired all in one motion.
What did it feel like to pull the trigger?
You know, it was a bizarre feeling. This guy fell to the ground as soon as I shot him. And it felt good, you know, and I don't know how that sounds, but it felt good enough for me to want to do it again. And so I walked toward him, and I was about to point the pistol at him and shoot him again. And a friend of mine who happened to be out there called my name and said, "No, Nate, you don't want to do that." And he ran up behind me and grabbed the gun from my hand. And so that gave Plaz enough time to gather himself, and he was holding his chest. He jumped up and ran into the parking lot and collapsed between some cars.
How did it feel to look at his face when you looked him in the eye?
Well, I mean, you know, I saw something that I hadn't seen before. This guy was an old head. He was like a very intimidating hood, and I had always been a little afraid of him. But after I shot him, I saw this look of horror on his face.
And that made you feel powerful?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Guns, I think, you know, guns in the hands of young people make them feel powerful. You know, having a gun was a serious power trip for me.
My guest is Nathan McCall. He's a reporter at The Washington Post and the author of a new memoir called Makes Me Wanna Holler, A Young Black Man in America. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. I'm back with journalist Nathan McCall. He's a writer with the Washington Post and the author of a new memoir called Makes Me Wanna Holler, A Young Black Man in America. Well, this guy you shot, this got you, you pled guilty to a lesser charge. You got 30 days, a $300 fine, and 1 year probation. A little later, you held up a McDonald's with some friends. You were the gunman. You got sentenced to 12 years. You served three of them, and then you were paroled. And life in prison really turned you around. You started reading. You started getting a discipline. You started working at various jobs in the hopes of maintaining some kind of discipline. What do you think it was that changed you? Did it have something to do with the solitude, the structure, getting away from your friends?
You know, that may have been a small part of it, but it certainly wasn't the prison itself. The prison environment is in no way conducive to a positive transformation. It's just not. But I was fortunate enough to run across some old heads who had been through the system several times and had gotten a fair amount of wisdom that they were willing to impart to some of the young bloods. And they would, you know, sit down and rap to me about life and about things. And I wrote about this guy who taught me to play chess, you know, and explained to me the philosophy of chess and talked about the parallels of between chess and life. And he was an inspiration. The thing that impacted me most deeply, though, was a book that I ran across almost randomly. I was in the Norfolk jail waiting to be transferred to prison. And it was overcrowded in the jail and I was miserable. And so I volunteered to push the library cart around on my floor to get out of my jail cell. And so I'd had, you know, have these books on this cart, and I ran across this book that had the picture of a black man on the cover, and it was Native Son by Richard Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked it up, and I leafed through it, and I couldn't put it down. It was the first book that I had run across that I could identify with. You know, it was the story of a young black man, Bigger Thomas, who was about the same age I was, 20 years old. And he saw the world as I saw the world. He was confused. He was frustrated. He was, you know, he both hated whites and feared them. And that's how I felt. When I finished, I broke down and cried because this writer had described all my feelings. And, you know, he had described my anger. It even described the pain that I felt.
So did this start you reading more?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was an amazing discovery for me that, you know, I just didn't think that there were people who wrote about those kinds of things. You know, the regular mm-hmm. guy on the street.
Should we interpret this to mean that the prison system really does work? People do get changed for the better.
That would be a tremendous leap of logic. No way. It wasn't the prison system. It was the book. It was the nature of the literature. You know, the way that I interpret it is that, you know, this is something that I should have run across in the school system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but all through my years in school, the things that I learned had seemed irrelevant to me. I didn't see myself in any of those pages. You know, and whether it was English literature or history or, you know, I couldn't look in any of those books and get a sense of my place in the world or, you know, the place of other black people. And that's important to everyone.
So when you got out of prison, you went to Norfolk State University, studied journalism. Then you got a job reporting with your hometown paper, the Virginia Pilot Ledger Star.
Yes.
Then you got a job with the Atlanta Constitution. And while you were in Atlanta, you were invited to apply for a job at the Washington Post. Now, when you were at the Post, a lot of what you wrote about was the prison system, reforms in the prison system and controversies in the prison system, programs for prisoners. What was it like for you to cover that as a beat?
Well, I had the first time I went out to the Lorton Prison and saw all those black men out there. I thought about the time I had spent in prison and all the black men who were in prison there. And that first day, I went home and I had the worst headache and I just had to lie down because it was so depressing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was often depressing for me to go back there. And you know, often the lines between my professionalism and my sense of personal responsibility got blurred, you know, because I would meet guys, you know, and see in them things that I saw in my old self. And I'd have to, you know, put the notepad aside and just have a brother-to-brother talk with them, you know. And I found myself testifying sometimes rather than covering news.
What's it like for you now that you've written this book and people know about your past, they know about your record? Is that changing the way people see you? Colleagues who maybe didn't know that much about you, or maybe people who you're covering now as a journalist?
Well, I'm still on leave of absence.
Uh-huh. So covering hasn't come up
yet. Right, that hasn't come up yet. But initially, when I first, you know, the book stemmed from a piece that I wrote from the Washington, for the Washington Post Outlook section.
Mm-hmm.
And when I decided to write that piece, it was about my life. And about the ambivalence I feel when I go home and see some of my old buddies on the block. When I decided to write that piece, I was scared to death because I had never written anything for public, you know, for publication about my background.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even talk to people on my job about my background. You know, if they knew it, they found out on their own because I didn't bring it up. And so I was scared that if I wrote this piece and it was published, that there might be a strong negative public reaction. But that didn't happen. When the piece was published, I got a lot of calls and letters from black people who said, you remind me of my uncle who went to prison. Or, you know, they'd say, you know, I've got a cousin who is just coming out of jail, and what do you recommend that I say to him? And surprisingly to me, I also got a lot of calls and letters from whites who said, you know, you helped me understand some things that I've been grappling with but had been unable to understand because I'm so removed from that whole experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, thank you. And some of them called and invited me out for coffee. And it gave me a warm feeling. It really, you know, it boosted my optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of reinforced for me the sense that people are basically good. You know, if given enough information, people will draw the right conclusions. And there was a time I would have never said that about whites, you know. But because of the response that I got, it reinforced that notion in me.
Nathan McCall, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nathan McCall is the author of the new memoir, Makes Me Wanna Holler, A Young Black Man in America. He writes for the Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the bebop era, Arthur Taylor was one of the most in-demand drummers. He recorded with Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, and John Coltrane. In the 60s, he left America for Europe. There he interviewed many of his fellow musicians while they were on tour. His book of interviews has been published in a new edition. Coming up, we talk with Taylor about his music. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Irrawaddy Tango by Burmese novelist Wendy Law Yeung. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. French President François Mitterrand says he wants Sarajevo to be put under the administration of the United Nations. The French leader also wants the NATO ultimatum to Bosnian Serbs around the city to be extended to other parts of Bosnia. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
President Mitterrand said we have to secure the lifting of the siege of Sarajevo. He said this week, France will call for a UN Security Council resolution that would put Sarajevo under UN administration. Mitterrand was speaking in a nationwide TV address. He said the Serbs must continue to comply with the NATO ultimatum in Sarajevo or face airstrikes in the future. He said he hopes the ultimatum leads towards peace, but he added a lot still needs to be done, such as ensuring the free movement of people and humanitarian convoys throughout the country. Mitchell suggested that the NATO ultimatum in Sarajevo be extended to other war zones in Bosnia-Herzegovina. However, a few minutes later, the defense minister said in a TV interview that he doubted that would be possible since the UN would first have to stop the fighting. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The U.S. admiral who would command NATO airstrikes in Bosnia if they were called for says the Bosnian mission is not over. Admiral Jeremy Borda is warning if the situation around Sarajevo changes, NATO will be prepared to strike. South African multi-party negotiators have approved several key constitutional changes. The changes are intended to persuade Zulu and Afrikaner nationalists to participate in upcoming elections. But the nationalists say they're still not satisfied. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The negotiators made several concessions to the right wing, including recommending a two-ballot system that improves the chances of small parties in regional elections. But the Conservative Freedom Alliance said the concessions are not enough. The alliance's Zulu members still demand stronger regional powers. And right-wing Afrikaners still insist that they be given a separate state. Despite the negative response, an emergency parliamentary session is expected to rubber stamp the changes next week. Several clashes in Natal province this weekend increased fears of bloodshed if the Freedom Alliance cannot be drawn into the campaign. In the worst incident, 15 African National Congress supporters were killed the night before they were to take part in a voter education program. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
Authorities are looking for Haitian refugees in shark-infested waters off the coast of the Bahamas. A small boat carrying several refugees capsized yesterday and was discovered about 3 miles off the islands. There have been 5 confirmed deaths, 4 of them children. 3 survivors managed to reach a beach. A local minister said the Haitians have been living there for years and tried to get Bahamian citizenship. This is NPR. Honda Motor Company says it will get rid of its equity stake in British carmaker Rover. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports from Tokyo.
Honda's decision was widely expected, though it's a painful one for the Japanese carmaker. Honda is widely credited with turning around the British automaker since it bought a 20% stake in the company in 1979. Honda saw its relationship with Rover as a way to gain entry into the European market. But this partnership was upset earlier this month. That's when the German car company, BMW, suddenly announced it was buying an 80% equity stake in Rover. Today, after talks in Tokyo with BMW's top management, Honda's president announced the company is pulling out of its partnership with Rover. The loss of Rover compounds problems at Honda, which will have suffered about a 5% drop in profits year on year, ending at the end of next month. Honda said it will pursue a more independent strategy to break into the European market. Divorced from Rover, it will have to. I'm Marjorie Sun in Tokyo.
Pakistani commandos stormed the Afghan embassy today in Islamabad, where three gunmen were holding five schoolboys and their teacher hostage. The gunmen were killed. The hostages were rescued unhurt. The Pakistani Interior Minister says the operation is complete. The gunmen had held the boys for 2 days with dozens more of their classmates. The gunmen had demanded $5 million and 2,000 truckloads of food for Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. That city has had great difficulty getting food because of heavy fighting between rival Islamic factions. The Brady Bill is supposed to take effect in a week. This requires a 5-day waiting period for the purchase of a handgun. There is still some confusion about the legislation. Gun dealers and law enforcement officials are still asking about paperwork and background checks. Several gun shop owners say they are not certain how to implement the law. At least one police chief in Ohio says he's not certain how specific background checks are supposed to be. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. After the rhythm of jazz turned to bebop, Arthur Taylor became one of the most in-demand drummers. He played on over 200 records, including now classic sessions with Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, and John Coltrane. Now Taylor leads his own band, Taylor's Wailers. This is the title track of his recent album, Mr. A.T. Back in 1963, Arthur Taylor went to Europe and ended up staying for 17 years, 10 years in Paris, 7 in Belgium. While he lived abroad, he interviewed many of his fellow musicians as they toured Europe. He published many of those interviews in his book Notes and Tones. A new expanded edition has just been published by DeCapo Press. I asked Taylor how he ended up in Europe.
There was a man who owned a Blue Note who was trying to get me to come and play there for many years. And he had offered me this 3-month contract. So I said, great, okay, I'll go to Europe. I was going to play with people like Johnny Griffin and Kenny Drew, men who I'd worked with most of my life. And I said, fine. And I had known Paris and known France, and I had liked Europe. So I took the 3-month contract, and then I stayed 6 months. And there was no reason to leave because I was very busy. I was having a good time. I was traveling around, you know.
Was there already a kind of thriving jazz scene in Paris when you got there of American jazz musicians?
Yes, it was great, too. It was very great. It was very healthy. And I guess Kenny Clark, the great drummer, he was the oldest, most, so he was most respected. And he knew a lot of people in government and people in very high office, you know, and at that time, the movie stars used to come and hear us, Van Damme and Brigitte Bardot, all those kind of people were interested in this type of music at that time.
Now, Kenny Clark is one of the first great bebop drummers. So was he helpful to you when you got to Paris, or were you a bit of competition for him?
Well, Kenny had always tried to encourage me. He always wanted to encourage me to study. Because, as I said, I was self-trained, and he always tried to encourage me. So he said, "You can be better. You're going to be better, and you can make more money and everything. You'd be more versatile, and you'll expand as a musician." But I never bothered. And there were other musicians who said the same thing. But then, when I moved to Paris, when I was living in Paris, Kenny opened a school, which was in the Selma Saxophone Building in Paris. And he insisted that I come and study. And if I didn't go and study, I would have to fight with him. So I didn't want to have a physical fight with someone who I respected and loved so much. And I'm serious about that. He was that vehement about it.
Was it a school that he was teaching?
He was a teacher. There were two professors. He and another classical Italian man, Agostini, who was from Italy. They had the school. And it went great. People thought I was crazy, though. I started out with the kids the first time you pick up a drumstick.
Well, really, because, I mean, you'd already played with everybody, with Bud Powell, Miles Davis, John Coltrane.
That's right.
Now you're back in school.
I had made 200 albums at the
time. Right, right. So what did you learn?
Huh?
What did you learn?
I found out what I was doing all these years.
Which was?
and I could refine it, and I could apply it technically.
So you felt you had more control?
More control, yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, how did it feel to be in classes with people who were picking up drumsticks for the first time?
It was interesting because you start at the basic. You start at the first thing you learn. I was in classes of maybe 8-10 kids from the age of like 10 to 16 or 17. First time they ever played. Some of them turned out to be nice drummers, too. That's the pleasure of seeing those things.
Now, how did you start playing drums?
Well, my family, everyone was... I guess I was the slowest one of the family, the least educated, the least everything in the whole family. And my sister was a psychologist and a classical pianist, and I didn't want to play piano. I didn't want to do anything, really. I just want to hang around with the guys or something. And my parents were always after me to study, and which I didn't want to do it. I never got along with the teachers, couldn't get along with anybody. So after I had an opportunity to have a career as an athlete, I was a pretty good athlete, which I'm finding out more and more now from some of my cousins and old friends, how good I really was as an athlete. And my father told me, he said, "You must be crazy. You know, how are you going to make a living being an athlete? You know, you can't play the professional sports and make any money doing that. You know, that's before Jackie Robinson and all that. You know."
Mm-hmm.
So music was like a second choice. And I chose music because I don't like to get up in the morning. I like to be on my time. I like to sleep in my time and do it on my time and not be on somebody else's time all the time.
No, but there must have been a point where music started to become much more important to you.
I really mean that. I don't want to get up in the morning. I don't want to be moving when everybody else is moving. When everybody's going to work, I want to be sleeping. When they're sleeping, I want to be out having a good time.
But didn't music become more important to you than just that after a while?
It's a pleasure to play music. I couldn't ask for anything more. That's the greatest thing I've ever done in my life, to be able to play music. That is a thrill of a lifetime. It's a thrill every time, even to this day. I've been doing it so long, but I'm still very excited to play music. I love it. It's a release. You don't have to be bothered with the ordinary things of life and trivialities when you really get involved in music.
My guest is drummer Arthur Taylor. His book of interviews with jazz musicians, Notes and Tones, has just been published in a new edition. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with drummer Arthur Taylor. Now, in 1957, you performed on a really important jazz recording, the Miles Davis album, Miles Ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And this featured arrangements by Gil Evans.
Yeah.
What did the session mean to you at the time?
Oh, that was thrilling. That was really thrilling. Because at the time, I was working with Miles' band. And we would finish working in the village and say 4, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, go to his apartment, and I would just sit there and have a drink and eat something, and I would watch he and Gil work on this music for the recordings session, which they'd spent months putting that together. And it was interesting to see people really work on something constructive, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let me play the beginning of the composition, Miles Ahead.
Thank you.
Did Gil Evans arrange the drumming at all? Did he give you a sense of what he wanted on there?
Well, I'll tell you what, at the time, to be honest, I came in this, I didn't want to do the date. Miles had convinced me to do this record and to play with this band, and we were working in Central Park with Hank Jones and Wendell Marshall, and we were doing this and doing just everything all at one time. And I didn't want to do it because I didn't think I was capable, you know. And he said, well, I wouldn't ask you to do it if I didn't think you were capable, you know. I said, well, I don't know. I'm not too experienced with a big band and all that, you know. And he said, don't worry about anything. Just go on and come in and play. And when I walked in the studio, Gil had about 5 or 6 music stands in front of the place, the position where the drums were supposed to be. About 10 sheets of music spread out, you know, about 7 or 8 feet long on these things. And I said, God, dog, listen to this. How am I going to get through this? And Miles walked in. And he walked over. Hey, how you doing? Hey, how you doing? Everything all right? And he took the music. He just took all the music and folded it up and put it on his music stand. And he told Gil, just let Arthur play what he wants to play, just how he feels it. And that was how we did it.
So did Gil Evans give you a sense of what he wanted at all? Or were you just on your own?
Oh yes, he was a very fine director, you know.
What would he tell you?
And he liked my drumming. So when you like somebody's work, it's easy to work with them, you know.
So what would he tell you?
Certain accents or something he would want me to do, you know, or maybe he would like me to play softer. He was very descriptive with his hands and his body motions.
Mm-hmm.
Which I found very interesting because it took us about 2 weeks, you know, to do the album. We were in there several days, you know, maybe 4 or 5 sessions. So I was around these people every day for quite a period.
You recorded with Thelonious Monk,
pianist
Thelonious Monk. Let me play something from 1959 that you recorded with him, a Thelonious Monk composition, Jackying. Drum solo. Did Monk want it to start with a drum solo?
That record has a special spot for me because everywhere I go, all over the world, Japan, Europe, any place I go, the people always say, "Oh, that solo or jacking with Thelonious Monk is so fantastic," you know. And I look at it myself. Thelonious that said to me, he says, yeah, give us an 8-bar introduction, play it on the cymbals, you know. And it was something very simple and very basic and very short. And that's my most famous solo. That's incredible. Everywhere I go, people look at me like I'm something special because of that solo.
So do you have to play that solo in concerts now?
Well, this is something, what I played, it's not a solo, it's just something that I basically do generally thousands of times, you know.
Uh-huh.
So it's not some great improvisation or something of the moment, you know. But other people look at it different, you know. So it's all right with me.
Now, Monk had a reputation of being very verbally non-communicative. I mean, even when you interviewed him, I think you sat with him for several hours and got about 2 pages of transcribed notes.
Correct, correct.
Interesting transcription, but not very verbose.
Yeah.
Was it hard to communicate with him musically?
No, Monk was a very direct person. Something I liked. He's probably too direct for this planet. People have to be a little. They can't deal with Monk because he looks you right in the eye and it tells you just where it is. It's very easy for him to say that you got a big head or you think you're better than somebody. He could say that very easily, and with the tone, it could make a person really upset. But musically, Monk was. It was very difficult to play with him because he is. Domineering, put it that way. He's domineering. in his playing, in his, yeah, that's the word, domineering.
Did you ever have trouble finding what was suitable to play behind his rhythms, which were so angular and jagged and unlike what anybody had played before?
Yeah, I found that very difficult. That was very, that's the hardest job I ever had, playing with Thelonious Monk. Very difficult, because he plays the end between off tempo. It's not slow, mm-hmm. it's a little bit just before slow, or too slow. Or if it's fast, it's just before it gets to that point where it can really, take off. Whereas it requires a lot more concentration. And at the time I was working with him, he was a stickler for timing. And he said to me one time, he says, look, I don't care what you play. I don't care how loud you play, or you know, but make it fit, which is what improvised music is supposed to be about.
So did your drumming change as a result of playing with Monk?
He thought so.
How did he think it changed?
He thought I wasn't nothing till I played with him. That's what he used to tell me. I couldn't play nothing till I played with him.
Was he more talkative in life than he was when you were interviewing him?
Oh, he was a beautiful man, lovely man, lovely man. Very, very humorous, very, very direct, uh-huh. and very kind. Yes, mm-hmm. I love Thelonious.
Now, your band, Taylor's Whalers.
Taylor's Whalers, yes.
Has musicians who are considerably younger than you are.
Yes, I'm older than their fathers.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so how does it feel for you to be, like, the father figure in the band as well as the drummer?
Yeah, it's not like I'm a father figure, because I have a tremendous amount of energy, and I'm getting better all the time.
Sounds like you don't want to be a father figure.
No, I don't, I'm a father figure. No. We all have, we're all equal level. We all have our end to hold up, and I'm going to do the job. But I have a tremendous amount of energy. They get tired before I do. It's funny. Yeah, I talk to the people, have a drink with the people, talk to the women, talk to the guys, get the money, collect the money, sign the contract, pay them, get the plane tickets, get on the bus, go over there, play all night, sweat completely like I've come out of a rainstorm, and then they're tired before me. I like it. It's nice.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Arthur Taylor's book of interviews with jazz musicians, Notes and Tones, has just been published in a new edition by DeCapo Press. Here's more from Taylor's album, Mr. A.T. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Bosnia?
Well, we'll have a report about what President Clinton had to say today and about the diplomatic maneuvering going on now. That's from Ted Clark. Also a talk with Andy Bowers in Sarajevo about people who are still skeptical of this ceasefire, but who at least are venturing out of their homes more and expressing more confidence that they can do so without facing artillery shells. Also, John Nielsen reports today on the legacy of environmental neglect and damage in Eastern Europe and some of the things that are being done to correct it. And on this President's Day, we'll hear from John Strasbaugh, who has collected photographs of presidents with celebrities.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Novelist Wendy Law Yon grew up in Burma. Her father was the founder and publisher of that country's leading English-language daily in the 1950s. He was arrested in 1963, 1 year after the democratic government was toppled in a coup. Wendy Law Yon has lived in the U.S. since 1973. Her first novel, The Coffin Tree, was acclaimed for its portrayal of life in the monsoon country. Now, 10 years later, Law Yon has published a new novel, Irrawaddy Tango. It combines a languid tropical setting with some fierce revolutionary politics. Critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
Irrawaddy Tango is the tale of a poor but spunky girl living in the fictitious Asian country of Daya, who seductively tangos her way into a marriage to the crackpot dictator of Daya. She's like Imelda Marcos, except ironic. When the novel opens, our heroine, who's nicknamed Tango after her trademark dance, is in prison. She's back in her demented husband's clutches after a 25-year exile. Tango's description of the clock in her prison cell immediately lets us know we're in the company of a shrewd, unsentimental storyteller. The clock was one of those battery-powered models. The power was on, the face was lit and buzzed faintly, but the hands had been removed. Of course, Tango says, I understood the purpose. In addition to not knowing the time, how much worse to be reminded that time still stares you in the face, that the clock keeps on ticking while your world is stalled in darkness. As Tango stoically awaits her fate, she flashes back over the past 50 years of her life. But it's the first third of the novel where Tango talks about her childhood and rise to power that's the most captivating. Wendy Law-Yone has a Dickensian gift for sketching eccentric minor characters who are totally believable. Like Carlos, Tango's first dancing partner, whose lofty pompadour gradually falls flat from unemployment. It's Carlos who teaches our heroine the formula for the perfect tango. All you need, he tells her, is two sad faces and four happy legs. After her marriage, Tango is kidnapped by rebel forces, divorced in absentia by the dictator, kidnapped and tortured by government police, and finally rescued by an American aid worker who takes her to live in Hollywood, where he peddles bad movie scripts. I have to confess, somewhere between Hollywood and Tango's return to Daya, my interest in her adventures petered out. She began to remind me of the Holly Hunter character from The Piano, a woman I might have rooted for if she had only once explained to somebody why she wasn't talking. Although Tango has a vivid narrative voice, she's also strangely mute about her motivations for her actions. Like, for example, she murders one of the other characters here, and I'm baffled as to why. It's tough to stick with such a cryptic character all the way through an around-the-world odyssey. Irrawaddy Tango is a fast-paced, magical, and I think ultimately frustrating novel. Tango may be a great dancer, but she needs to give those of us trying to follow in her footsteps more pointers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Irrawaddy Tango by Wendy Law-Yone. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The U.S. has told China to improve its human rights record if it wants to continue to have most favored nation trade status. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with China scholar Orville Schell about human rights in Tibet, where an ancient culture has been nearly destroyed under Chinese occupation. Schell reports on Tibet in a new PBS Frontline documentary. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.